We usually think about financial markets as these perfectly rational, finely tuned machines.
Right, like giant calculators.
Exactly. The prevailing wisdom suggests it's a place where math and logic always win out, and where asset prices perfectly reflect all available information.
That's the textbook assumption, yeah.
But what if that foundational assumption is completely backward? What if the markets are actually driven by illusions, flawed perceptions, and, biases that actively warp the underlying economic reality?
I mean, if that's true, it fundamentally rewrites our entire understanding of the global economy.
It really does.
Because if the foundation of the market isn't objective truth, but rather human perception with all its inherent blind spots, then the traditional models we use to invest, to value companies, to understand macroeconomic booms and busts, they're fundamentally flawed.
We're no longer trying to solve a math equation at that point.
Exactly. We are trying to navigate a psychological landscape that alters itself based on how we look at it.
And that is the exact paradigm shift we are getting into today. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Our mission today is to help you understand how investor biases don't just reflect reality, but actively change it.
We've got a really heavy stack of financial literature to go through for this one.
Oh, yeah. We are diving deep into the core investment philosophies of legendary billionaire investor George Soros, specifically unpacking the framework laid out in his book, The Alchemy of Finance.
And we are pairing that with historical breakdowns of the 1992 currency crisis.
Plus, an in-depth profile of his brilliant behind-the-scenes strategist, Stanley Druckenmiller, charting his staggering 30-year track record.
The ultimate goal here is to give you the analytical tools to spot the market's biggest traps and opportunities based on this specific philosophy. Okay, let's unpack this. Where do we even start when dismantling the idea of a rational market?
Well, the best place to start is probably with the establishment view that Soros is arguing against in the first place, which is the efficient market hypothesis, or EMH.
Right, the cornerstone of modern finance. Yeah, it has been the cornerstone of academic finance for decades now. EMH, alongside the concept of rational expectations, basically argues that investors are inherently rational actors who optimally allocate resources.
They don't make emotional mistakes, according to the theory.
Exactly. The theory assumes that market prices are completely efficient, meaning they instantly incorporate and express the aggregate effect of all available public and private information.
So in that traditional textbook model, if a stock is trading at $50 or a currency is pegged at a certain rate, it's because that is the absolute, objective, correct value based on every single data point currently in existence.
That is the core assumption. And the theory implies that financial markets naturally tend toward a stable equilibrium.
A perfect balance.
Right. Any deviation from that equilibrium is just viewed as temporary noise, or maybe the result of a sudden, unpredictable external shock. But it paints the market as a self-correcting mechanism that inherently balances itself out over time.
But Soros introduces a concept that completely dismantles that baseline assumption. He calls it the theory of reflexivity.
And reflexivity argues that markets do not tend toward equilibrium.
Not at all.
In fact, under this framework, equilibrium is just an academic illusion. It doesn't exist.
So how does he break that down?
He breaks this dynamic down into two distinct, interconnected functions that are always operating simultaneously. First, you have what he calls the cognitive function.
Okay, the cognitive function.
This represents how market participants attempt to understand the environment they are operating in. And the critical insight here is that an individual's understanding will always be inherently flawed or incomplete.
Because the world is too complicated.
Right. They are trying to comprehend a highly complex reality that is constantly shifting, meaning perfect information is practically impossible.
We are all looking through a distorted lens, making assumptions based on incomplete data and our own personal biases.
Exactly. And then comes the second half of the equation, which is the participating function. Soros sometimes refers to this as the manipulative function.
And this is where action comes in.
Yes. This describes how participants act based on those flawed cognitive beliefs. The truly revolutionary part of this theory is the assertion that these actions actively change the underlying economic fundamentals that the participants were trying to observe in the first place.
It creates a continuous self-reinforcing feedback loop.
A massive loop, yeah.
Expectations shape market facts, and those newly altered facts turn around and shape future expectations.
Right. Like if speculators collectively expect an asset's price to rise, They allocate capital and start buying.
And that massive influx of capital physically pushes the asset's price up.
Exactly. When the price rises, it provides false validation of their initial, potentially biased expectation. They look at the rising price chart and assume their thesis was correct, which then draws in even further capital.
So the markets are frequently operating on totally incorrect assumptions.
Yes. But those assumptions appear correct because of this self-reinforcing mechanism.
Which brings us to a conceptual cornerstone of his entire philosophy, the human uncertainty principle.
What's fascinating here is how Soros compares this to the physical sciences.
Like physics.
Yes, specifically quantum physics. You have the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, where the mere act of observing a particle alters its state or position.
Right.
However, humans operating in financial markets introduce a level of uncertainty that vastly exceeds physical particles.
Because particles don't have opinions.
Exactly. The immutable laws of science, like thermodynamics or gravity, do not change their behavior based on what human beings think about them.
Gravity functions identically, regardless of whether you understand the math behind it or not. You drop an apple, it falls.
But human social reality, on the other hand, is entirely constructed by human perception. We make economic decisions based on what we believe and expect to happen, not on absolute certainties.
And because our decisions are based on flawed knowledge?
And because those decisions actively alter the landscape, the results of our actions will always generate unexpected outcomes.
To really make the mechanics of this theory concrete for you listening, we need to examine how this actually plays out on a macroeconomic scale.
We need a real-world example.
Let's look at the events of 1992, specifically the event that famously broke the Bank of England.
Oh, this is a classic.
So picture this. It's 1992, and the UK is a participant in the European Exchange Rate Mechanism, or the ERM.
Which was a precursor to the euro, basically.
Right. This monetary system essentially forced the British pound to peg its value to the German mark within a very, very narrow trading band.
And the fundamental economic flaw that set the stage for a reflexive trap becomes super obvious when you analyze the macroeconomic divergence between those two nations at that specific time.
What was going on in Germany?
Well, it's the post-Berlin Wall era. Germany is absorbing the massive, massive costs of reunification that involves heavy government spending and printing a lot of money.
Which causes inflation.
Exactly. To cool their economy down and fight that resulting inflation, the German central bank, the Bundesbank, aggressively raises interest rates.
But the UK is facing the exact opposite economic reality.
Right. They're struggling.
They are enduring a really painful domestic recession. And in a standard monetary policy environment, a central bank combats a recession by lowering interest rates to stimulate borrowing and investment.
You want to make money cheap so people spend it.
Exactly. But because the UK has tied its hands with the ERM, legally binding the pound to the German mark, they are forced to keep their interest rates artificially high to maintain the peg alongside Germany.
So you have a sovereign government actively suppressing its own domestic economy just to maintain an artificial currency valuation.
The powder keg.
It is. The global market observes this tension and the cognitive function of reflexivity kicks in. Speculators perceive that the British pound is severely overvalued given the weakness of the underlying UK economy, and they determine the situation is just mathematically unsustainable.
That belief immediately triggers the participating function. Speculators begin taking massive short positions against the pound.
They start betting it will fall.
And this brings us to Stanley Druckenmiller, who was serving as the chief investment officer for Soros's Quantum Fund at the time. Druckenmiller identifies this structural vulnerability in the ERM.
He sees the crack.
He sees the reflexive trap closing in on the Bank of England, and he pitches a massive trade to Soros, wanting to bet $1 billion. Against the pound.
And Soros's response to that pitch is just a defining moment in Wall Street history.
It really is.
He looks at the asymmetrical risk-reward profile Druckenmiller has outlined and asks, you call that a position?
$1 billion. And he says, you call that a position?
Yeah. Soros recognized that the Bank of England's defense was fundamentally untenable and pushed his strategist to double the leverage, taking a $2 billion position instead.
The sheer volume of selling pressure from Quantum Fund to other speculators forces the Bank of England into a desperate corner.
They had to react.
To defend the currency peg, the UK government begins hiking interest rates even higher, right in the middle of a recession, remember. And they burn through a staggering $26.9 billion of taxpayers' foreign exchange reserves, just frantically buying up the flood of pounds being dumped on the open market.
But the defense ultimately collapses under the weight of the market's capital. It was too much. the UK is forced to withdraw from the ERM entirely, allowing the pound to free fall to its true market value.
And Soros's fund walks away with $2 billion in profit.
In a matter of days. But the critical takeaway here, when viewed through the lens of reflexivity, is how the government's defense mechanism actively deteriorated their own economic foundation.
Right, by hiking interest rates to double digits just to defend the currency, the Bank of England strangled the already weak British economy, driving asset prices down and bankruptcies up.
It was a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Their actions to fight the speculators actually accelerated the deterioration of the UK's economic fundamentals, perfectly validating the speculators' initial thesis that the economy couldn't sustain the peg.
It is the ultimate proof that the market isn't just a passive mirror reflecting economic data. The aggregate belief that the pound would fall actually forced the fundamental policy changes that ensured the pound would fall.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because you don't have to look back to a sovereign currency crisis in 1992 to see this architecture at work. We can apply this exact same framework to the 2008 global financial crisis.
Well, absolutely. The 2008 crisis is masterful, albeit completely devastating example of a reflexive boom and bust cycle.
It played out perfectly according to the theory.
Rather than looking at the surface level narrative of just greedy bankers, we have to look at the underlying illusion, the prevailing false concept that hijacked the market's cognitive function at the time.
And what was that core illusion?
The belief that financial engineering, specifically the packaging of subprime mortgages into collateralized debt obligations, or CDOs, had mathematically eliminated localized default risk,
thereby making housing a perpetually appreciating asset class.
Exactly. The market bought into the assumption that because these mortgage-backed securities were sliced up into tranches and diversified across different geographic regions, a nationwide synchronized housing crash was just statistically impossible.
That cognitive belief is what allowed rating agencies to stamp these highly toxic assets with AAA ratings.
Right. And that false cognitive belief drove massive demand for these products. To satisfy Wall Street's insatiable demand for more yield and more CDOs, the participating function took over.
The action phase.
Yes. Mortgage originators fundamentally altered the underlying lending reality. They completely abandoned traditional underwriting standards,
issuing loans with zero money down and no income verification,
just to generate the raw material needed to package into these securities.
The intense demand for the financial product actively degraded the quality of the underlying asset itself.
But because trillions of dollars were flowing into real estate as a result, home prices naturally skyrocketed.
And this altered reality, the surging housing data, was then fed right back into the risk models, seemingly proving the initial false belief that housing was a risk-free investment.
This highlights a crucial characteristic of reflexive markets: the asymmetry of boom and bust phases.
They don't look the same.
Not at all. A boom is a lengthy, gradual, self-reinforcing process. It takes years to build the positive feedback loop as expanding credit and rising asset prices feed off each other.
But the bust operates on a completely different timeline.
Entirely. The bust arrives at a specific inflection point, the exact moment the underlying false concept is exposed.
Once the market realizes that geographic diversification doesn't actually protect against systemic rot, the narrative instantly fractures.
And the unwinding is vicious. The massive leverage that was used to amplify returns on the way up creates a devastating negative feedback loop on the way down.
Forced selling triggers margin calls,
which triggers more forced selling, distorting liquidity and accelerating the collapse far faster than the bubble was ever built.
So what does this all mean for you? If you are managing your own portfolio, analyzing macroeconomic trends, or simply trying to understand the forces dictating monetary policy, recognizing these prevailing market illusions is your absolute most valuable tool.
You can't trust the surface narrative.
The market is not going to smoothly guide you to a safe equilibrium. You have to actively interrogate the gap between the popular narrative and the underlying fundamental reality.
And this brings us to how Stanley Druckenmiller actually synthesized these theories into a tangible, highly lucrative trading strategy.
Because it's one thing to know the theory, it's another to trade it.
Exactly. When you examine his track record at Duquesne Capital, it kind of defies conventional financial logic. From 1986 to 2010, he averaged 30% annual returns.
30%.
Growing his fund from $1 million to $12 billion without a single down year.
Sustaining a 30% compound annual growth rate for over two decades requires an entirely different operational framework. You look closely at his methodology from the sources, it really boils down to three core pillars.
Let's break those down.
The first pillar actively contradicts modern portfolio theory. It is the home run style, often referred to on Wall Street as being a pig.
Yeah, traditional finance heavily preaches broad diversification to mitigate portfolio volatility. Don't put all your eggs in one basket.
Right.
But Druckenmiller argues the exact opposite when it comes to generating exceptional, outsized returns. He advocates for extreme concentration.
Put all your eggs in one basket and watch it like a hawk.
The philosophy is that you put your capital into a very small number of baskets and watch them obsessively. The old Wall Street adage is, bulls make money, bears make money, and pigs get slaughtered. But Druckenmiller argues that when you have overwhelming conviction in a reflexive macro trend, you actually have to be a pig.
You have to press your advantage.
You must press your advantage and maximize your leverage when you know you are right.
However, running a highly concentrated, highly leveraged portfolio requires an almost superhuman level of emotional discipline, which leads directly to his second pillar. Recognizing and reacting to mistakes instantly.
This is huge.
This is not about possessing a flawless crystal ball. It is entirely about the mechanics of how you manage risk when your thesis is proven wrong.
And the defining example of this discipline occurred during the 1987 stock market crash.
Black Monday.
The Friday before the infamous Black Monday crash, Druckenmiller committed a massive analytical error. He had been shorting the market, anticipating a drop.
Okay.
But on Friday afternoon, believing the market had hit a support level and was primed for a technical bounce, he aggressively flipped his entire portfolio.
Oh, wow.
He went from being net short to 130% long, utilizing leverage to bet heavily on a market rally.
He went all in on the long side, directly ahead of the largest single-day percentage drop in stock market history.
Literally the worst possible timing. But over the weekend, he realized his technical analysis was flawed, and the support levels he relied on were completely broken.
So what did he do? Because most managers in that scenario just freeze.
They fall victim to the sunk cost fallacy.
Right, holding on to the losing position and hoping for a market rebound to save their ego and their capital.
Druckenmiller did the exact opposite. On Monday morning, as the market began its historic freefall, he didn't wait and hope. Within the very first hour of trading, he ruthlessly liquidated his massive long position.
Taking a tremendous localized loss, I imagine.
Massive. But he immediately flipped his portfolio back to aggressively shorting the market.
Because he possessed the egoless discipline to instantly accept his error and align himself with the new market reality, he captured the massive downside move and actually ended the month of October 1987 with a net profit.
It is a masterclass in risk management. You have to be willing to be wrong and fix it fast.
And the third pillar of his playbook is arguably the most critical for understanding the modern financial era we're in now. Prioritizing liquidity over earnings.
Yeah, traditional equity analysis teaches you to obsess over corporate fundamentals.
What are the company's profit margins? What is their forward price to earnings ratio?
Exactly. But Druckenmiller argues that focusing too heavily on micro-level corporate earnings blinds you to the macro forces that actually dictate asset prices. The true engine of the market is central bank liquidity.
He monitors the flow of capital from institutions like the Federal Reserve obsessively.
To understand this, you really have to look at the mechanics of quantitative easing, or QE. When central banks engage in QE, they create new money to buy massive quantities of government bonds and mortgage-backed securities from financial institutions.
Flooding the banking system with cash.
And intentionally driving down bond yields.
Because safe assets like government bonds no longer offer a meaningful return, investors are essentially forced out onto the risk curve.
They have to buy equities, real estate, and alternative assets just to generate yield.
Which artificially inflates the prices of those assets regardless of their underlying corporate earnings.
It is the ultimate reflexive distortion. The central bank alters the reality of the money supply, which forces investors to bid up asset prices, which in turn creates a wealth effect that central banks then point to as proof that their policy is working.
It's a closed loop. And looking at the decade ahead, Druckenmiller offers a deeply sobering macroeconomic prediction based on this exact dynamic.
He does. He highlights that over the past decade, global central banks have injected roughly $30 trillion in quantitative easing into the system.
$30 trillion. That is an unprecedented flood of artificial liquidity.
And he argues that this era of free money has entirely broken the traditional market feedback loops. It has encouraged rampant misallocation of capital, allowed zombie companies to survive on cheap debt, and severely distorted asset valuations.
So what happens next?
Because of this structural damage, he predicts the global markets may face a lost decade of prolonged stagnation.
The system simply has to digest $30 trillion of excess. When you pump that magnitude of artificial certainty into an ecosystem inherently governed by the human uncertainty principle, the resulting inflationary pressure and subsequent tightening cycle could lead to years of flat returns as the reflexive bubble slowly deflates.
Pulling all of these concepts together, the overarching philosophy really demands a total reassessment of how we view global finance.
It changes everything.
The market is not a moral force. It is not an omniscient calculator optimally balancing supply and demand. It is an amoral, deeply human, and highly fallible ecosystem.
It's driven by collective perceptions, biases, and structural incentives that don't passively react to the world, but actively engineer the economic reality we all inhabit.
Achieving true financial insight isn't about perfectly forecasting the future, because the future is a moving target that we are actively altering with our current decisions.
It's about identifying the prevailing market illusions, rigorously managing your risk exposure, and cultivating the discipline to adapt instantly when the fundamental facts change.
And, you know, this framework also exposes a profound and deeply unsettling reality about the global power dynamics inherent in the international financial system.
The macro structure of it all.
Right. When you apply the theory of reflexivity to sovereign nations, you see a stark division between what Soros identifies as center countries and peripheral countries.
Center countries, like the United States or the United Kingdom, possess a massive structural advantage. They issue and borrow debt in their own sovereign currency.
While peripheral countries, typically developing or emerging market nations, do not have that privilege at all. They are forced to borrow capital denominated in foreign currencies, usually the U.S. dollar.
And that structural difference creates a devastating imbalance during a reflexive macro crisis.
Absolutely. When a severe economic shock hits, center countries can deploy quantitative easing and massive fiscal stimulus. They can essentially print their own currency to recapitalize their banks and protect their domestic economies from the worst of the fight out.
But peripheral countries simply cannot do that.
No, if they print their own currency to pay off dollar-denominated debt, they trigger hyperinflation and total currency collapse.
Therefore, to satisfy international lenders and maintain access to global capital markets, peripheral nations are routinely forced to implement brutal austerity measures.
They have to intentionally induce deep domestic recessions, slash public spending, and raise interest rates.
Effectively liquidating their own economic growth to protect the balance sheets of the capital providers in the center countries.
It suggests that the illusions and systemic biases driving our global markets aren't simply creating localized financial bubbles. They are actively sustaining a deeply unequal global architecture.
The rules of the reflexive game are structurally engineered to insulate the wealthy center from the consequences of uncertainty, while forcing the periphery to absorb the ultimate costs of those market failures.
It's a very sobering thought.
It is a heavy, profound thought to leave you with today, but an essential one as you refine your understanding of global finance. If the entire global market operates on biased human perceptions rather than objective truth, what are the long-term consequences when those biases are structurally designed to keep the center in power while the periphery pays the price? How stable is our global reality, really? Give that some thought. Thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.